Hang on, I'm having a panic attack. What would I have seen? Oh God, thank God. Okay. Whew. Daniel LaPlante. I think that's how you say his name. LaPlante, maybe. Have you ever heard of him?
I have not.
Okay, well then this will be a good one, but it's a little short. It's the same amount of words pretty much as the other short one that I had. So
okay, I'm ready.
So this week's episode is on Daniel LaPlante. And oh, by the way, if you're listening, like and subscribe, because we never say that. And I'm trying to remember.
Like and subscribe, follow us on Instagram.
This is Daniel LaPlante. I'm just going to go through his early life first and then go into kind of what he's known for. Daniel LaPlante grew up in Townsend, Massachusetts in the 70s and 80s. So his birth year was 1970. So in his early childhood, he didn't have your typical childhood, but he did have your typical childhood for a murderer. He was sexually and physically abused by both his father and his stepfather. And he exhibited many of the signs of an abused child. So when he wasn't doing very well in school, which he was dyslexic, but he also just like wasn't doing well in other areas. Like he was known as like the smelly kid. It didn't seem like he cared a lot about his appearance at all. And he didn't have any like self-improving behavior. So he just didn't apply himself at all. And on top of the abuse from his father, he also had been seeing a psychiatrist for ADHD, and the psychiatrist also began abusing him during their sessions, which
that stuff always. Poor child. That's three in a row of like trusted adult figures.
Yeah. And that's what they mention a lot in the stuff that I was reading, is that it's like all people you are supposed to have trusted, which I don't know, this might get dark, but whatever. Like when I listened to this one podcast about people who had been abused, and I had talked about it last week privately with you, but they were saying like all these things that we're supposed to send our kids to, like, you know, like soccer practice or like Boy Scouts and all this stuff, those are all like becoming like the bad places for kids. So anyways, so by his early teens, he had developed an affinity for breaking into people's houses. It started off like with a motivation of petty theft. Like he would just steal random stuff, but then he liked to play mind games with people. And so instead of taking things, he started leaving objects, or instead of like taking or leaving anything, he would like move things around in their house. Like sometimes furniture, sometimes just small objects.
That's so creepy.
Yeah.
I think that's creepier than someone taking something, because you can always just like pit, like say like, oh no, I just lost it. But if something were just to appear in your house, that's super creepy.
No, my dumbass though would be like, where did I get this? I don't remember having this. Yeah. Or I would just like flip out at everybody in my house and be like, where did this come from? So the first incident, which I think is the creepier of the, there's basically two incidents. So in 1986, at this time he would have been 16, he was able to get the home phone number of a family. Their name was the Andrews family. And it was a family of a single father and two girls named Annie and Jessica. The mother of the family had recently passed away from cancer. And so I don't think he really knew any of this when he had originally called them, but obviously he learned it through time. So he calls the house and he talks to the girls on the phone. He's like the original catfish. So he calls them and claims that he had gotten their phone number from a friend of theirs at school. He called the house and talked to the girls. Like I said, he was like the original catfish. So he had claimed that he got their phone number from a friend of theirs at school, but in reality, police believe that he ended up getting their phone number while breaking into a house of somebody that was actually a friend of theirs. So although the girls found it strange that they were talking to a boy that they haven't ever met, they still ended up talking to him. And the oldest of the daughters, named Annie, had struck up a relationship via the phone, which, I mean, is like, I feel like this is just like our version of AIM or AIM.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like leaving like away
old school MySpace. Like, ooh, who's this person? I'm like randomly commenting on something. And then you strike up a friendship.
Yeah. Or you just literally add them out of nowhere, which like we were so unsupervised. It's so bad.
Oh, I know.
What was your AIM username? Did you have one?
God, this is so embarrassing. Yeah. It was Malibu Brunette 94. I had never been to Malibu. My hair was brunette and I was born in 1994, but otherwise no idea why it was Malibu Brunette 94.
Yeah. Well, I had two. Mine, looking back now, one of them was not okay. So I look a little Asian, so I made mine Chinese boy 324, but I became woke at a certain time. And so I had made a second one that like got rid of the other old one, and then it was Smurf 1994. So
okay, that's better.
My MySpace name was Prime as Rib for a super long time, and I thought that was so clever.
Well, oh gosh, my Twitter name for a little while was Cosmic Taco. And it was also Intoxication, S-E-A-N. I thought it was really good, but people would always be like, what the hell is Intoxication?
Your name in my phone forever has been Sean Baden instead of Braden. I've always liked that.
I think for a little while, my Twitter was Blackout Braden as well. I think David had me in his phone for a little while as Passion Fruit.
I get it.
Yeah, anything with Sean in it would work. Yeah.
Back to God damn it, my goddamn stunner foiled a good joke again. Back to your pre-Sean-tation. God damn.
Or a presentation.
Yes.
Okay, so the oldest daughter, Annie, had struck up a relationship via the phone with him. LaPlante described himself on the phone as tall, athletic, blonde, and good looking. And so that's how Annie thought he looked. And after many conversations over the phone, the two decided to finally set up a date. So when Daniel finally arrives at Annie's house, she was shocked to find out that instead of a hunky blonde guy that she was expecting, it was actually more of a dorky, dark-haired guy who was kind of short and just generally unkempt. They described him as like greasy and gross, which like we learned earlier, he didn't really care about his appearance or anything. Mm-hmm. So obviously this caught her off guard, but she continued the date anyways, and they went to a local fair. And so at the fair, Daniel obsessively asked Annie about her mother's death and all the details of it. And eventually she just found a way out of the date. And I think she just lied and said she had to go home or something like that, but she ended up making it home safely. So flash forward, I don't know how much longer after this date this happens, but Annie and her sister Jessica set out to contact their mother via seance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, old school, I don't know if they've gotten a Ouija board or what, but they go into their basement and they perform a seance. And at first it seemed unsuccessful, but then later that night, the girls reportedly heard scratching and knocking on the walls. And so they stayed up all night asking the spirit of their mother questions and getting responses via knocks. So like, I don't know the exact questions or anything, but I'm imagining like, oh my gosh, are you our mom? Knock once for yes, twice for no. And there's like, you know, so I think you can see where this is going, but it's still just very, very creepy. So this continued over several nights, but eventually it turned into something more eerie. Objects in the house began disappearing or relocating, and the furniture began being moved from one side of the room to the other while nobody was home. And so the girls thought that they had tapped into some dark energy, and the dad thought that the girls were acting out in response to their mom's death. And so he just like sent them to therapy, which good for him, like to be like a progressive, cause I don't know, therapy was kind of frowned upon at the time, right?
Yeah, I feel like same with like other than the whole molestation part, like he got like Daniel went to therapy as a kid.
Yeah, for like
ADHD. I think that's early.
I'm sure that the school had something to do with that. I'm sure the parents didn't help get him in there or anything, but yeah, I thought that was, like he was doing his best, but he was wrong. The dad. So at this point, it had been very normal for the knocking and the tapping to occur, especially late at night or while the girls were home alone. And remember, they're like 16 and I think 12 or something. So they're old enough to be home alone. So one particular night, the girls were sitting in their living room and they had heard more tapping, but this time it was coming from the basement. And so the girls went downstairs armed and ready to fight. They had like kitchen knives and stuff like that, which... I just like couldn't picture myself in that situation. I've never been like so actually scared. Well, I mean, they had something to be scared of.
Yeah, if I was alone, absolutely not. But if I had like someone with me, I'd probably be like, okay, let's go check this out and get weapons. Although 2 weeks ago, I guess it was now, but like whenever that really big storm happened, like I think it was a Monday night or a Sunday night, one of the two, but I was sleeping and all of a sudden I kept hearing like cabinets opening and closing in my kitchen. Or at least I thought it was my kitchen. I think I figured out that it was one of my outdoor patio doors, like swinging open and closed, but it sounded like someone was just like opening and closing all of my drawers and all of my cupboards. And so I was like trying to get my dog to come to me, but she was just like sitting in this like kind of scared, like nervous, like sitting in the living room.
Oh,
and
that's
my cat
worst,
like was in, yeah.
Yeah, you're expecting your dog to like gauge your reaction of like, are you overreacting or not?
Or like, yeah, like just give you some sort of like accompaniment whether you're scared or like to go in first. But yeah. She would not come over there. And then eventually like, I turned the light on in the office and like saw into my kitchen. And then my cat like was walking towards me. And I was like, okay, it was just Naomi like walking in and out of a cabinet. And I was like, it probably wasn't, but at least that's enough for like to get me back to sleep.
That's what it usually is for us. We, when we first got Gretchen, our cat, she eventually learned how to open cabinets and she was like obsessed with it. I used to have to tie them closed. It was like living with a poltergeist. Like mm-hmm. I would come out in the morning and all the cabinets were like wide open and she could even get the drawers in the bathroom and everything. So it just looked like somebody had just like blew all the cabinets open.
I know. That's what I'm thinking. It was that, or it was definitely my patio door, except that makes a different, like more rattling sound. And this was much more like wood to wood closing and opening. Yeah. It was really scary. And I was really scared, but I like grabbed one of my camping knives that I keep in my room. I have like weapons placed like periodically throughout my room with like, or I guess more so methodically, like I know exactly what they are and why they're there. But no one else has their weapons, but they
are. I'm paranoid enough to keep weapons, but I also know that if actually something happened, I would be way too frozen with fear to actually do anything.
I think I'm a fighter based on like events.
Oh, I'm for sure not. I'm a runner. I would like be like, I'm so tiny, I can just like jump out my window or whatever and probably get away, like take whatever they want. So the girls went downstairs armed and ready to fight. They brought kitchen knives, but instead of finding what they were hoping to find, a person, maybe, I don't know. Instead, they found a message on the wall written in what looked like blood. And it said, I'm in your room, come and find me. And so the girls ran to a neighbor's house and waited for their dad to come home. And instead of believing them, he again just sent them to counseling, thinking that it was
like a prank they pulled.
Oh, yeah. Well, so he still scary. Doesn't really think that it's a prank, but he thinks that they're like acting out, like they're like just having an unnatural way of dealing with the death. So yeah, he sends them to counseling. He doesn't believe them, but he's not like mad, I don't think. Like he seems supportive. And then a second incident occurred weeks later where the girls found a message that said, I'm back, find me if you can. And so this time the neighbor inspected the house and told the father what it had looked like in the house. And then the girls had also done this. I think the dad works nights or something that they have to keep calling him like this. But when he comes home, the house is in even worse condition than the neighbor had described and that the girls had described. So they're like, he's like, okay, this time it was clear somebody was in the house in between when my neighbor had called and when I read. So he goes upstairs and is like checking out his bedroom. And upon crossing the room, the father was confronted by a disturbing surprise. In his house was a teenage boy, obviously Daniel LaPlante, standing in his dead wife's clothes, wearing her makeup, and carrying a hatchet.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Dude, I know. When I first read that, like, this is the creepiest part of the story, obviously. And I was like, oh, like, I know we've talked about, like, some weird fucked up murders and stuff, but, like, this, like, shakes me to my core way more than, like, anything like that, you know?
I don't like that at all. Oh, my gosh.
Oh yeah, it's so creepy. So there was a struggle between LaPlante and the father, and the struggle ended when LaPlante escaped and disappeared. So he like wriggled free and like literally disappeared. And so police later investigate the house and saw that the messages were not written in blood, but rather in ketchup, which I assume that they had already learned, because how would the girls not notice that the first time? They still took this seriously and they searched the whole house. And one officer found a small crawl space behind a cabinet built into the wall of Annie's room. It was in this space that the officer found Daniel LaPlante curled up inside the wall. Like they straight up just found the kid living in the wall that night, like while they're searching the house. And that's okay, why he could just-
That's almost as creepy as the wearing the mom's clothes and oh, shoes. That's so scary.
Yeah, like, I mean, it equally is as creepy. And I think that's like creepier how he disappeared so quickly, because he literally went into their walls. Like, why would you expect that, you know? So the officers arrested LaPlante and searched the space further. And they had discovered that Daniel had been living inside the walls of Annie's house. Throughout the walls were tunnels and passages made by Daniel to move around quickly. And there were even peepholes so that he could watch the family.
Oh, okay. That's super, super, super creepy.
Yeah. I mean, it gets worse. That's like what I have as the title of the next part of this. It gets worse. So Daniel was incarcerated, but was under the age of 18. So he was let out of juvie within a year. And I mean, technically he didn't murder anyone or anything. It's just breaking and entering, and maybe, I don't know exactly what they had charged him with, but so within a year, he was out and up to his old shenanigans. In a routine burglary, he ended up finding handguns in somebody's house and he kept them. And a few nights later, he broke into the home of a family named the Gustafsons.
I'm just like in utter disgust and shock of this kid, like freaking out about like someone living in my walls.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so he goes and breaks into the house of the Gustafsons. When he enters their house, he finds a pregnant Priscilla Gustafson and her two children. Her husband was away at work when he broke into the house. I believe this happened during the day. I don't know for sure, but it feels from what, you know. So the husband's name was Andrew, and when he returns to find his wife raped and shot multiple times in the head from up close. And moving on to the rest of the house, he finds his kids. So his son, who was 5 years old, was drowned in the upstairs bathroom. And his daughter, who was 8 years old, was drowned in the downstairs bathroom. And so to this day, nobody really knows why LaPlante killed this family. It was thought that it was an opportunistic event because he found the weapons and now he had this. And there's like all these like psychoanalytics of like, it's, you have to have less personal confidence to kill with a gun than you do with a hatchet. So maybe that's why before it wasn't so.
That's just such an escalation.
Yeah, it's extreme. And it's weird because like, why shoot one, drown the other? I don't know. It's just, it's creepy.
Based on my profiling experience at the FBI, AKA watching Criminal Minds, my theory is that it's because he never had a normal family. So he like saw that as like the perfect family and like what he wanted. And so then he like acted out because he like couldn't have it or didn't have it.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely could be, or that makes sense. But you would think, I don't even know. I'm not even going to try to get it. I was like thinking maybe you would think he would want to kill the dad, you know, because of all the stuff that like male.
Or like maybe he wanted to take away everything the dad had, like see, like take away everything.
Yeah. That makes sense actually. Okay, so the police found out that it was LaPlante, or at least they had him as a strong suspect. They questioned him, but he denied it was him, saying that he was watching TV that day and that he attended his niece's birthday party as well. And so later the police come to question him again, but he just takes off running into the woods. Like he's on the porch while they're walking up and he just takes off. And they lose him in the woods, but they search his house and his property, and they find the gun that was used to shoot Priscilla, a pair of sneakers matching footprints found in their garden, and a sock with saliva that was believed to be used to get Priscilla, and some more stuff that was creepy. But this is like early DNA, so I Googled it, and then DNA testing came out 4 years before, or 3 years before this, so I think that they had like some DNA stuff that they could go off of, but not like fingerprints were a thing, but I don't know if saliva was, you know? Okay, so LaPlante's life on the run was very short, but quite eventful. He ended up running away to a town nearby where he kidnapped a local woman and stole her vehicle. Somehow she escaped and was able to make it to safety, but a different person called the cops and said that they saw LaPlante in the area. And so after 2 days of searching for him, the police found him hiding in a dumpster at a lumber yard, which is so gross. And I feel like just like sums up.
He was better at hide and seek earlier when he was in their walls.
Yeah. But like, why, dude? Why do you got to live in walls and dumpsters? I don't know. Like,
there's things in between that would have been much more practical if you could have hidden.
You could have hid under the dumpster even. You didn't have to go in it.
Around it. Yeah.
So he pleaded not guilty in court and had spent the whole trial showing no remorse. He was later found guilty of murder for 3 victims and was sentenced to 3 life sentences. And this blows my mind. Guess how many years 3 life sentences is in Massachusetts?
Ooh, in Massachusetts? 40 years.
Close. It's 45. They're 15-year terms each.
That is not a lot.
No, that's not a life sentence. What?
Whose life is that? Yeah, that's an insanely short life sentence.
Yeah, I think that's really weird. Like 45 to me seems like a life sentence, not 3.
Yeah,
but interesting. Whatever, that's the law, I guess. So keep in mind, he was 18 when the sentencing occurred, so he is actually set to be out in 2032. And I actually didn't do the math, but I'm guessing what, he'll be around 60 something, 63 or something
like that.
But anyways, he's still in prison to this day. He appealed in 2017 for a chance at parole. but he was denied, even though he made like this big apology, but this was the first time he ever apologized. And at this point, the husband of the wife, or of the lady that died and the two children that died, had already been dead for 3 years. So it's like, why did he wait to apologize till after? In brighter news, I thought I'd end it on a little bit of a brighter note. The father and husband of the three victims, Andrew, before he died in 2014, he ended up meeting a nice woman who was also a widow. And I think this is so cute. At their wedding ceremony, they each wore two wedding rings.
Oh, that is really sweet.
Yeah. So he seemed to have moved on without forgiving. And he didn't seem to like to revisit the incident, but happy that he found new love.
And yeah. That is really sweet. I like that. Good ending. Yeah.